Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
Rutgers University. They settle a strike, ratify the contract, and then find a way to screw over the workers, many asking, hey, where's my back pay? Today on the show, the Glacier case under the microscope. How bad is it for strikers? And the North Shore Labor Federation. Welcome to the Thursday, June 15th edition of America's Workforce, where we are available on at least six platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Pandora, and Stitcher. We have two guests on the show today. It's the return of Andrew Strom. We had him on the show a couple of weeks ago talking about organizing at an independent contractor for Amazon. Amazon didn't like that. Today, we're going to talk about the Glacier case, and I'll get to that in a minute. A little background on Andrew. He's been a union lawyer for, my gosh, three decades now. He's an associate general counsel of the service employees in a national union. That would be Local 32BJ in New York City. He's also a senior contributor for the On Labor blog, and that's what we're going to talk about today. He did a posting on the Glacier Northwest versus the International Brotherhood of Teamsters case. That decision came down from the U.S. Supreme Court at the beginning of this month, and as expected, all six Republican appointees on the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the employer. You know, this is not what you call a union-friendly court. Let's be honest here. Quick background on the story. When drivers at a concrete company, this was outside of Seattle, Washington, when they went on strike, their employer, Glacier, responded by suing their union in state court, alleging that the union designed the strike to sabotage the company's property. And the case involved the application of a doctrine going back 60 years. We'll talk about that. Now, let me explain. The Supreme Court here is reviewing a decision from the Washington Supreme Court, but after the Washington court issued its decision, the General Counsel of the National Labor Relations Board issued a complaint against Glacier alleging that the strike conduct at issue was protected by the National Labor Relations Act. And it should have ended there, but it didn't. But it's almost like the justices went out of their way to find a case where they could come down on unions. And that's exactly what happened. Now, bottom line, this could have been a lot worse. We got a couple of comments here. Mary Kay Henry, who heads Service Employees International, said, "We are pleased that this decision by the U.S. Supreme Court does not change labor law and leaves the right to strike intact. The right to strike is fundamental to our freedom as working people." And she went on to say, "We appreciate Justice Jackson's powerful dissent with regard to the specific facts of this case, which now should continue to work its way through the National Labor Relations Board." That was Mary Kay Henry. There's a lot of opinions on this right now. And Andrew's going to give us his and talk about what this means for workers who go on strike. It's very important to know your rights. Len DeCosimo will be joining us later in the show, and he is the Executive Secretary President of the North Shore AFL-CIO Federation of Labor, which represents about 85,000 people in northeastern Ohio. And he's going to talk about his new role, also talk about the fact that he's president of Local 4, the American Federation of Musicians, and he's been on a roll there. In fact, he's got some contract talks coming up with the Cleveland Orchestra. We're really going to zero in on the Issue 1 campaign. It's important that we get the information out to vote no. And this is the issue that the legislature put on the August 8th ballot in the state of Ohio, which would require a 60% majority to change the Constitution. We're going back over 100 years here. Right now, it's 50% plus one to change the Constitution. And many are saying, if the legislature gets its way on this, we could see right to work happen in the state of Ohio. That could happen because, again, supermajority, GOP side, not union friendly. And definitely an attack on democracy. One person, one vote. That's pretty much the rallying cry here. So Linda Cosimo will be joining us as our second guest on the show. Now a brief look into the world of labor. This segment brought to you by good folks at Boyd Watterson Asset Management. Rutgers University administration officials have botched the promised payment of retroactive salary increases, all one after that week-long strike by three campus unions in April, thus causing financial hardship for some of the most vulnerable and lowest paid educators at the university. This according to union leaders. Leaders at the Rutgers Adjunct Faculty Union say only a few of the nearly 2,700 lecturers they represent received the full back pay they were owed when the university was supposed to include the retroactive increases in paychecks distributed on June 9th. Some lecturers, those who taught last fall but not in the spring, received nothing at all. And union leaders say the administration is threatening not to pay them until September at the earliest, and not at all if they don't return to teach then. Brian Sachs is an adjunct faculty union vice president. Brian said this is an outrageous violation of our contract, especially the threat to not pay some of our lecturers at all for work they've already done. Our members are deeply angered by this. President Holloway's administration needs to commit to paying the retroactive increases to all adjuncts, or they will face protests and possible legal action. Members of three unions representing more than 9,000 educators, researchers, clinicians, and librarians, the Adjunct Union, as well as Rutgers AAUP, which is the American Association of Union Professors affiliated with the AFT, which represents full-time faculty, grad workers, postdoctoral associates, and counselors. They ratified new contracts in early May, following a months-long contract campaign and the first educator strike in Rutgers history. This goes back well over 260 years. We talked about that on the show. In fact, we had one of the strikers on. Biggest gains in the contracts went to lowest paid educators who were not making a living wage while working for one of the most renowned public universities in the country, Rutgers. We're talking Rutgers here. Adjunct lecturers won a 43.7% increase in their minimum per credit pay over 4 years. And that includes almost 30%, a 30% increase retroactive to July 1 for the current 2022-2023 school year. Grad workers represented by Rutgers AAUP in a similar basis won just over 32% increase in their minimum salaries over 4 years. Amy Higers, president of the Adjunct Union, Amy said, our retro pay for the classes we already taught this past year should have been thousands of dollars. Many of us were counting on that after so many years of not getting a living wage. The head of human resources stated in writing that we would get what we were owed in our paychecks on June 9th. But now they're trying to back out of their commitment to a significant percentage of us, and that is completely unacceptable. Union leaders say their members are also reporting problems with retro pay, though it's not as widespread and drastic as for the lecturers. The Adjunct Union has launched a petition now calling on Rutgers President Jonathan Holloway to promise that his administration will pay all lecturers what they are owed now. After the unions went on strike in April, this is what the petition reads. The Rutgers administration agreed to a groundbreaking union contract that finally raised adjunct faculty pay toward equity with other faculty and provided them with greater job security. But this overdue expression of respect for the vital role that adjuncts play at Rutgers has been undermined by the failure of the administration to implement retroactive pay to all adjuncts on time. Finally, union leaders say their members are raising their voices and organizing actions to make sure the administration gets the message. The petition concludes Rutgers needs to give adjunct faculty members the money they are owed immediately. Everyone who taught this past academic year needs to be paid what they are owed. Rutgers must honor our contract, and they need to do it now. I mean, come on. It's a signed contract. Let's get it over with. Jeez. All right, in the third attempt to fill a years-long vacancy of a permanent general counsel, this would be at the Federal Labor Relations Board. This is the federal version of the NLRB, the FLRA. President Biden nominated Suzanne Elizabeth Summerlin. Now, this board governs relations between the federal government and its employees. The agency issues unfair labor practice complaints and investigates and prosecutes labor charges on behalf of the 1.2 million civil servants in bargaining units. Now, get this. Our Senate has not confirmed a nominee to this role in 4 years, 2019. If confirmed, Summerlin will replace acting general counsel Charlotte Dye, who's been serving in that role since March of 2021. Now, in February of this year, the U.S. Government Accounting Office reported that Dye's service was in violation of the Vacancies Act, as it had extended well beyond the 300-day allowance for acting service for a presidentially appointed Senate-confirmed position. So, come on, Senate. We need somebody there to head the Federal Labor Relations Authority. And you know what's going on here. You've got some hardcore anti-union folks are saying, no, 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 no. We'll just delay, delay, delay. One more here. Journalists at CNET, which is a technology news company, are pushing to join a union and are citing the use of, what? Artificial intelligence as a major concern. Bloomberg News is reporting about 100 CNET employees, including writers, video producers, and editors, hope to join the Writers Guild of America East. CNET came under fire earlier this year when they began using artificial intelligence to write content for news stories online. And after an internal audit, CNET had to go back and issue corrections on more than half of the AI-generated or written stories. So there you go. Yes, the technology is there, but it may not be all that accurate. All right, quick break. When we come back, the Glacier case under the microscope, an On Labor contributor. Back in a few minutes.
This is America's Workforce.
It takes LIUNA to build North America's infrastructure. From roads and bridges to schools and skyscrapers, the men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, build the projects we depend on. From constructing the Freedom Tower on the site of the former World Trade Center to untangling Washington, D.C.'s congested interstate, LIUNA members do the work that matters. Find out what it takes to be built by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
America's Workforce is brought to you in part by the United Steelworkers. You can find more at usw.org.
America's Workforce is sponsored in part by Boyd Watterson Asset Management, LLC. Find out more about our investment solutions tailored to meet the needs of Taft-Hartley funds at BoydWatterson.com.
We're the nurses, firefighters, and claims representatives that help keep our government services running. We respond to natural disasters. We care for our nation's veterans. And we investigate discrimination in the workplace. We are federal and D.C. government workers. And we are proud to serve the American people. Working in more than 70 agencies across the government, we know we can fulfill our mission because our union has our back. Learn more at AFGE.com. .org. Paid for by the American Federation of Government Employees, AFL-CIO.
America's Workforce Radio is sponsored in part by the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades, District Council 6, representing painters, glazers, drywall finishers, and sign and display industry workers. They remind you that belonging to a union is your right as an American.
America's Workforce is presented by the Laborers International Union of North America. Feel the power right now at LIUNA.org.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And remember, you can check us out on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Real simple there. AWF Union Podcast. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the Ohio Federation of Teachers. You can find more at oh.aft.org. We should be checking in with Melissa Cropper, who is president of the OFT, also secretary treasurer of the Ohio AFL-CIO. That'll be next Tuesday. Right now, though, let's go to New York City. And joining us on our live line, we had him on the show a couple of weeks ago. His name is Andrew Strom. He's been a union lawyer for three decades. He's the associate general counsel for the Service Employees International Union. That would be a local 32BJ in downtown New York. Now, he's not speaking on behalf of the service employees. He's a contributor, a senior contributor to a great blog. It's called onlabor.org. I go to it just about every day, onlabor.org. And we're going to talk about a Supreme Court decision that came out a couple of weeks ago. And anytime, anytime the Supreme Court takes on a case involving unions, we all have to hold our collective breath because we have a conservative majority. And I think we all remember what happened, I believe it was 2018, when the Janus decision came out, which reversed precedent going back to the 1970s. Well, this case is called Glacier Northwest versus the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. It was a local out of Seattle, Washington. Andrew Strom, welcome back to America's Workforce. Thanks for joining us today. And I know you posted your blog on labor.org, and you did a really nice job on that. I would like you to share that with our listeners. Well, I'm going to start off with this question. Were you surprised about the 8-1 decision? Let's pick it up right from there. Go ahead.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think, as you said, you can never be surprised by any kind of anti-worker decision by this Supreme Court. And I think it's really important for your listeners to know that, you know, that the Republican appointees on the Supreme Court are just so predictably and virulently anti-worker. And, you know, any case where it's workers against bosses, they're going to rule on the side of the bosses. And, you know, when the Republican candidates talk about, you know, putting judges on the courts, you know, they'll talk about some of the culture issues. They don't really say, oh, and by the way, we're going to put people who are going to favor bosses over workers, but that's what they do. And I think, you know, some of the coverage of the case got a little bit sort of clouded by the fact that two of the Democratic appointees, Justices Kagan and Sotomayor, joined the majority. And I think that what happened there was that was a sort of strategic move by them, because what you have on the court is you have, you know, you had three of the justices, Gorsuch, Alito, and Thomas, who really wanted to go much further in this case and really, you know, roll back, you know, 50 or 60 years of precedent and let employers sue striking workers and unions kind of willy-nilly. And I think what happened here is that Justices Sotomayor and Kagan joined with three of the other Republicans to give them a majority that's very narrow and doesn't on its face purport to change the law in any way, although in practice I'm worried that it will.
So it's almost like Kagan and Sotomayor kind of cut a deal here, because it could have been worse. That's what I'm hearing. It could have been worse. Can you explain that part? What
sure.
did they do to make this different?
Sure. Yeah. So just I think probably briefly, because maybe not all your listeners are following so closely what the case is about, I'll try to very briefly summarize it for people. So this is a case involving drivers who work, truck drivers who work for a concrete company, and the company and the workers have had a union, you know, had a contract. The contract expired, and the company knew that a strike was likely and was likely to be imminent. And the workers worked sort of staggered shifts, So some people started at 2 in the morning, and then others started 3 in the morning, 4, 5, 6, 7. And the union had made a decision that they were going to wait to start the strike until everybody was working. So instead of just calling, say, the strike at 2 a.m., they called the strike at 7. What that meant was that some of the workers, or a lot of the workers, were out in their trucks with concrete in them. And the concrete, if it stays in the truck without the drums rotating, will harden after 20 or 30 minutes and damage the trucks. When the strike was called, the workers all went back to the plant and left their trucks, everybody left their trucks running, and they all said to the supervisors, hey, the trucks are running, you know, we're on strike, you guys deal with them. And it turns out that the company was able to deal with them. I mean, they had to sort of scramble a bit, build some bunkers to offload the concrete, and but there was zero damage to any of the trucks. I mean, that's one of the things that's sort of shocking about this, is that this whole case is based on, like, threat of damage that didn't actually happen. So nevertheless, the company sued in state court, and they accused the union of, quote, intentional and malicious sabotage. And they said that they wanted damages for their, you know, whatever additional expenses they incurred for the cleanup and, you know, whatever lost profits that they suffered because they had to throw out the concrete. And they sued in state court, and it went through all the levels of state court. It went through the trial court, it went through the intermediate court, and then it went all the way up to the Washington State Supreme Court. And that really should have been the end of it. You know, I think the other thing that's important for people to understand is that the U.S. Supreme Court is unlike any other court in that it picks and chooses which cases it hears, right? So they only hear about 70 cases a year, and they decide which cases they want to hear. So the only reason they heard this case was because some of the right-wing justices clearly saw this case as an opportunity to change the law in a bad way and to, you know, give employers yet another tool to use against workers. And so now getting back to your question of, well, what was the actual holding in the case? What the holding in the case was is that the way this case was sort of litigated was that when the initial lawsuit was filed, there's a provision. One of the ways that that lawsuits can get resolved is the defendant in a case can say, okay, even if everything you say is true, you still don't have a case as a matter of law. So that's what happened here. So there wasn't a trial. There wasn't a process of sort of bringing the facts out. So the case was decided in state court just based on the allegations that the company made. And so what this Supreme Court said was, well, if you just look at those allegations that the company made, we think that they did make out a case that should have survived a motion to dismiss. Their case should have gone forward based solely on this idea that the union struck in a way where there was a heightened risk of damage to the trucks. And the other three justices, the other three Republicans, wanted to do was say, well, anytime there's any damage to any company property, the company should be able to sue. So in other words, they would have said, well, you can sue just because you had to throw out some concrete. And the majority is very clear that that was not a basis, that would not be a basis for letting the suit go forward. They said that that it's not true that just because, you know, a strike creates risk to perishable goods, that the strike becomes unprotected. And so that was, I think, the helpful part of their decision, was to make it clear that, yes, workers can still strike. Yes, the strike may cause a company to throw out something that's perishable, but that doesn't mean that the strike is unprotected.
So the bottom line, this could have been a much worse situation for organized labor. That's what I'm reading from your blog, from various blogs right now. But I'm still a little bit unclear on how Kagan and Sotomayor kind of made this less damaging. Let's put it that way.
Right. Well, I guess it's less damaging in the sense that they shut out this notion that any time a company says, well, your strike hurt our, you know, we had to throw some stuff out because of the strike. We couldn't sell things that we would have otherwise been able to sell. We couldn't deliver things we would have been otherwise able to deliver. And so we should be able to sue the union for the damages that are caused by the strike. And it seemed like there's at least three justices on the court who were going to buy that argument. But I think it is one of the things I think that is worrisome is that, you know, this is a problem when people play defense, is that when people play defense, it's not as stark to everybody what's going on. And so here you had Justice Jackson, Ketanji Brown Jackson, dissenting on her own. And she wrote a very forceful opinion, really laying out what's at stake here and why the case really should have come out the other way, and mm-hmm. why this really is, it is a kind of terrible decision. I think that the labor, you know, people are sort of breathing a sigh of relief because it's like, well, they didn't roll back the clock, you know, totally. They didn't completely, you know, they didn't, I'm trying to think how to, you know, what to say, you know, it's like they only, it's only a flesh wound, you know, so we should all be grateful for it, right? But it really is, it's a very indefensible decision. I mean, I can walk through some of the reasons why it's so very indefensible, and I'm happy to do that.
Okay, let's do that. Let me take a quick break here.
Sure.
This is really fascinating. I read one opinion. This is from a professor at Georgetown Law who described the decision as a Trojan horse. Mm-hmm. I want to pick up on that, and I'd love to hear your comments. Andrew Strom joining us on our live line, contributor, senior contributor to onlabor.org. If you go to that website, you can read his blog about the Glacier Northwest case versus the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. Fascinating. Linda Cosimo will be joining us later in the show on behalf of the North Shore Federation of Labor. Back in a few minutes.
You're listening to America's Workforce with Ed Flash Ferens.
It takes LIUNA to power North America with affordable energy. The men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, have the skills needed to build and maintain oil, natural gas, nuclear, solar, and wind projects that are shaping America's energy future. From new energy tech to retrofitted facilities, LIUNA members do it all. Find out what it takes to be powered by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
This portion of America's Workforce is sponsored by EyeMed. Switching to managed vision care may save your fund money and deliver a better experience. Go to EyeMed.com/union to learn more.
There is unity and strength for workers.
We are the USW.
We are the USW.
The United Steelworkers.
The largest industrial union in North America.
We represent 850,000 members in the U.S., Canada, and the Caribbean.
We work in metals,
rubber,
chemicals,
paper,
oil refining, atomic energy, and the service sector.
We are steelworkers, standing strong and fighting for what's right.
You're listening to America's Workforce, and this upcoming segment is brought to you by the United Labor Agency. They connect people with employment. 216-666-2185. You can find them online at ulagency.org.
A great union requires a reliable election system. Survey and Ballot Systems is a trusted election partner with more than 30 years of expertise in managing union elections. By partnering with SBS, your union can ensure it gets an auditable process and a high level of customer service. SBS is here to help you conduct your union vote securely, transparently, and with trust building always in mind. Visit surveyandballotsystems.com to learn more.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And remember, you can check us out on at least six platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Pandora, and Stitcher. When you get an opportunity, here's what you do. Just sign up and receive our shows on a regular basis and give us a rating. We always appreciate those five-star ratings, so please keep them coming. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the United Labor Agency, where you can find more at ulagency.org. Let's go back to our live line. Joining us from New York City today is Andrew Strom, senior contributor to the blog onlabor.org. You want a lot of union news, all kind of union news over there, onlabor.org. They're connected to the Harvard Law School. And we're talking about the Glacier Northwest case, which came out earlier this month by the U.S. Supreme Court. And we're getting all kind of opinions. There's many in labor saying, oh, you know what? It could have been worse. And some are saying, yeah, it's still not good. But anytime, and I mentioned this in the first segment, anytime you got a conservative majority on a court with a union case, you got to be frightened. You got to be frightened about that. And you know what? I'd like to ask you later in this segment here, what is the message to unions? Because a lot of unions are paying close attention to this. But one professor out of Georgetown called this like a Trojan horse. And I think we know the story about the Trojan horse. They thought it was a gift, but the soldiers were hidden inside. And then they attacked. Is that a good way of seeing what's going to happen here, Andrew?
I think, unfortunately, it might be. Because I think what that's a reference to is that, on the one hand, you could say, well, this is just a very particular case on a very particular set of facts. But the reality is that this really encourages employers to go into state court across the country, wherever they can, and try to make the same argument. And they're going to be making this argument to, trial court judges in Alabama, in Texas, in Florida, in, in Nebraska, you pick the anti-union cities or places across the country or states, and they're going to be making this argument, and they're going to say, look, the Supreme Court said we could go forward if we make these kinds of allegations, and so we're making these allegations, so our state court suit should be allowed to go forward. And that's what's going to happen, and you're going to have these state court judges, some of whom are quite hostile to unions, who are going to make decisions that are going to be let's take this one step further. Let's take this one step further. Let's see how far we can push this. And that's, where we anticipate. Because one of the things that, when Congress passed the National Labor Relations Act, one of the things they did was they created a federal agency, the National Labor Relations Board, which is supposed to adjudicate these cases. And the only reason this case really went forward at all is that the employer here took some words out of context from an earlier case, right? A case where the Supreme Court had said policing of actual or threatened violence to persons or destruction of property has been held most clearly a matter for the states. And they meant that to be, look, if you're on strike, you can't break windows and slash tires and think that you're going to avoid liability in state court. Like this, that's what the state courts are for, right? The state courts deal right with those kinds of matters, right? But they're not supposed to get in and say like, oh, you didn't give enough notice when you went on strike, right? They're not supposed to come in and say, because it goes both ways, right? It goes for employers too, right? Employers lock out workers and they're not supposed to say, oh, you didn't give workers enough time to build up their savings before you locked them out, so your lockout is illegal under state law, right? These were supposed to be issues where, the National Labor Relations Board deals with, the economic weapons of, labor and management, and the state courts are supposed to deal with, matters relating to violence. And this is really, breaking that understanding.
Now, you mentioned a previous case. Is that the San Diego Building Trades Council versus Garmin, which goes back like 60 years? Is that what you're referencing
there? That's one of them, yeah. There's a couple of them. There's that case. So that case, that Garmin case, is a case where the Supreme Court had said, as long as there's activity which is arguably protected by the National Labor Relations Board. The states are supposed to stay out of it until the National Labor Relations Board has weighed in. There's another case, a case called Machinists, which the court doesn't discuss at all. And that was a case that I think they should have discussed because it really is relevant to this case. That's a case where workers had a concerted refusal to work overtime. And the National Labor Relations Board said that's not a protected thing, right? In other words, that's not a form of strike that the National Labor Relations Board protects. So if workers are fired for doing that, there's no recourse to the National Labor Relations Board. But the Supreme Court had said in that Machinist case that there's this sort of no man's land where things are quote-unquote unprotected, but that still doesn't mean that the states can come in. That those are supposed to be things where, as they put it in their case, in their decision, those are left to the free play of economic forces, right? So the, you know, whether, like I said, whether a lockout was timed in a way to be especially harmful to workers, let's say right after their Christmas, you know, credit card bills come in, right? Or whether workers strike in a way that is unprotected, those still were supposed to be left to the, you know, the free play of the market, not supposed to be for states to come in and say, oh, if it's not protected, then we're going to regulate it.
Yeah.
And so, but that's really what this opens the door for, is for, you know, sort of mischief by state courts to come in and say, oh, we're now going to let these lawsuits go forward.
Yeah, so when it comes to the Supreme Court, I think we ask for clarity on an issue, whether it's good or bad, legal or not. Instead, what we're seeing here is it could be 50 different opinions because we've got 50 different states. And that's how we see this going forward. Very, very confusing, but I like the way you put it all together. There's some good spots. There's some bad spots. Okay, final question here. To unions. We got a lot of unions that listen to this show. In fact, we're heard in 49 states. We're heard in 11 countries. But let's concentrate on the United States of America, because as you indicated, I mean, there's some states that are not friendly to labor, mainly right-to-work states, mainly in the South. We're seeing organizing there. That's a bright spot. But the bottom line is this. What's your message to the worker? And it doesn't have to be a cement truck driver. It could be anybody that's thinking about going on strike. And we're seeing a lot of strikes right now. I mean, there's a lot of strikes going on right now. I guess in one word is how you have to be careful how you behave when you're on strike.
I think
that's a given, but I think I need to hear more.
Sure. I mean, I think that the narrow point to come from this is that workers and unions probably do need to be a little bit careful about, you know, when they walk off the job, making sure that they're not, you know, leaving a machine on that could cause damage, or they're not turning a machine off in a way that could cause damage, that they're, you know, walking out in a way that doesn't cause a risk of aggravated damage to the property. But I think the bigger point that I would make to people is that unions can't be cowed by this, right? I mean, the strike is still the best weapon, the most effective weapon, at least in some cases, that workers have. And where workers have that weapon, you know, they need to use it, because you can't just, you know, throw up your hands and say, well, we're going to face some hostile, you know, court in our state, and so we better not strike, because what else are we going to do?
You know, right.
And we can't be that scared. But, you know, I think a little bit of caution about, you know, making, not creating especially bad facts, being a little bit more careful about, how to shut down the equipment before you go out, those kinds of things, is probably in order. I mean, look at what Justice Jackson said. I'll end with this word, this part of what she said in her opinion. She said, workers are not indentured servants bound to continue laboring until any planned work stoppage would be as painless as possible for their master. So I think those are words that people should take to heart.
There's a reason they roughed her up in those hearings. Yeah, Andrew, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Yeah, those of you in unions, you got a weapon. Just be careful how you use that weapon. Andrew Strom, senior contributor on labor.org. You take care. Thank you for what you brought to the table today, okay? And stay in touch, all right?
Okay, thank you. Bye.
All right, quick break. When we come back, we're going to link up with Len DeCosmo, the new president of the North Shore Federation of Labor.
This is America's Workforce. More shows available at awfradio.com.
It takes LIUNA to keep America running. Over 70,000 public employees are part of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, delivering critical services such as healthcare and emergency response, as well as maintaining roads and sanitation systems. Even the National Postal Mail Handlers Union, representing over 47,000 U.S. postal workers, is affiliated with LIUNA. Find out what it takes for LIUNA to keep America running at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
America's Workforce is brought to you in part by the Communication Workers of America. You can find more at CWA-Union.org.
This segment of America's Workforce is brought to you by Survey and Ballot Systems. SBS has been providing unions with secure and flexible election options for over 30 years. Visit SurveyandBallotSystems.com to learn more.
America's Workforce is brought to you in part by the Iron Workers. You can find more at ironworkers.org.
You'd like to upgrade your fund's vision care, but you need to roll back the clock on the cost. Roll it back to the 70s. iMed offers members 76% average savings versus retail on eye exams, glasses, and contacts. Enjoy similar benefits to an indemnity plan, but with consistent savings and a better experience. Endorsed by the National Labor Alliance, iMed takes a consultative approach to tailor your vision insurance benefits. Learn more at iMed.com/union. Figures based on client data. Visit iMed.com/union for more details.
America's Workforce is brought to you in part by the United Auto Workers. Find more at UAW.org.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And remember, you can check us out on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Real simple, AWF Union Podcast, AWF Union Podcast. All right, let's go to line number two right now. Joining us on our live line, been on the show a number of times, man, wears many, many hats. Len DeCosmo is his name. He's a musician. He's a singer. He's the head of the American Federation of Musicians Local 4 in Northeastern Ohio. And now he is president of the North Shore AFL-CIO Federation of Labor. Website is NorthShoreAFLCIO.org. Len DeCosmo, my first question to you. Do you get any sleep now?
Flash, I'm taking the Winston Churchill approach where you take cat naps in the afternoon and then you sleep maybe 3-4 hours in the early morning. And the balance is working rather well in the short term.
Winston had a pretty good thing going there for a while, no doubt about that.
And it was just for a while, but sure.
Yeah, exactly. Well, congratulations on the new leadership position here. And we should point out that the North Shore AFL-CIO Federation of Labor is the unionized voice for 85,000 working people from nearly 150 local unions in Cuyahoga, Lake, and Geauga counties. And they report directly to the national AFL-CIO. So congratulations on that, and of course, did you tell me that there's a convention with the musicians? What is that, next week?
That's right. Next week, the Triennial International Convention of the American Federation of Musicians is happening, and I have the pleasure and the honor of serving. I've been the longtime financial committee secretary for the AFM. It's a real working convention where not only do we have elections of officers, and we also do a lot of busy work with bylaw revision and trying to address all of our constituencies in the music industry. I look forward to it. It's good work, man.
Yeah, very good work. Yeah, and I want to talk about what's going on locally with Local 4. But first and foremost, we have a big issue, and you know this, in the state of Ohio. That is issue one, And it's going to be on the ballot for now, anyway, on the 8th of August. Early voting will start about a month before. It's important to get people to the polls, and also, if you're not registered, to get registered. But this is crazy, Len. This is an election that should not be happening because the legislature said, no more August elections. Nobody shows up in the middle of summer. Why bother? They're too costly. And it's kind of interesting. I don't know if you know this, but speculation was this was going to be about $20 million to cover this election. $20 million. But the legislature, I understand, allocated 15. They said, well, maybe not. Maybe not $20 million. And I was just reading that in Cuyahoga County, it's going to be at least $3 million, $3.2 million, according to the latest quote here from the Board of Elections. So I can only imagine that North Shore AFL-CIO Federation of Labor, for you, this is priority number one, right?
It's issue one for us. Issue one for us. The first thing I'd like to say is July 11 is the deadline to register to vote. So remember and spread the word. July 11 is the date, the last date to register to vote. And July 31 is the last date that registered voters can get absentee ballots. But really, Flash, I need a new set of bifocals to find out which side of the mouth this political party is speaking from. It's simple that majority rule is a reasonable position for the citizenry. And the idea that you need a supermajority to amend the Constitution is not honest and inclusive democracy. One person, one vote. That's the message that we all should be carrying around. And it's just staggering to see what's happening in the state house.
Yeah, this goes back well over 100 years, and I just got this posting from the Alliance for Retired Americans. In America, especially in Ohio, no matter our color, background, or zip code, we value our freedoms. We wrote our rights into the Ohio Constitution to protect
right.
us from corruption in the state house by the robber
Amen.
Barons. Yeah, and they go back to J.D. Rockefeller, Marcus Hanna. Boy, that was an interesting time. In northeastern Ohio, and for a big part of the Midwest, I mean, Rockefeller, that was a national name. And they go on to say, now the Ohio Senate has brought enough influence in the state house with help from interest groups from outside the state to impose his and their will over the voters. But the wealthy few have always tried to call the shots, seeking to divide and control us so they can claim the wealth our work creates. That's from the Alliance of Retired Americans. So what's the game plan here, Len? I'm hearing statistics that like 8 to 10% of registered voters usually go to the polls when you have an August election. What are we going to do to motivate them?
Well, we've been starting already at the Central Labor Council. We're doing mobilization in the workforce. We're talking to our rank and file. We're also reaching out to the community at large with events. And I'd like to use this platform to talk about two that are coming up this month. At Kane Park, Evans Amphitheater in Cleveland Heights, we're having a Juneteenth celebration that's sponsored not only by the Music Union, but the Music Performance Trust Fund, the North Shore, and Ohio Alliance for Community Engagement. We're going to have a big party there. Also, SEIU 1199 is having a rally at 5:30 on June 22nd at their offices on Shaker Boulevard, 13,000 Shaker Boulevard. We're going to spread the word to disenfranchised voters and community members. A lot of people, the majority of the people, don't know about this issue. And we're going to lift our voices. We're going to make our voices heard.
Yeah, we're talking about an attack on democracy. It's pretty clear. And the funny part about it, they're saying, well, you know, we've got these special interest groups that, if we pass a law, they can try to change the law. And we have to point out that special interest groups from outside the state of Ohio are the one that are backing to pass issue one. So.
Almost every major newspaper and media outlet, governors on both sides of the aisle. Flash, I just read that the former CEOs of Huntington Bank, Procter Gamble, Ron Richard of the Cleveland Foundation, the current CEO, are all coming out against this as well. What we need is not gerrymandered leadership that is amplifying cultural issues to the exclusion of common sense kitchen table issues. You know, I think since this Republican Party has demonstrated they can't receive a majority of the votes unless they put their thumbs on the scale, they're putting their whole foot on the scale now. It's outrageous.
So once again, vote no on August 8th on issue one. And you said the last day to register in the state of Ohio is July 11th. Did I get that date correct there, Lynn?
July 11th, the last day to register. July 31, the last day to receive an absentee ballot, to apply for an absentee ballot.
Gotcha. Okay. All right, Len, let's switch gears here a little bit. Let's talk about what's going on in Local 4, the American Federation of Musicians. I see you had a music festival promoting living female composers. Talk to me about that.
Well, we try to be the change we want to see in the world. And the She Scores is an annual new music festival celebrating living female composers. This year, we had all three evenings at Drinko Recital Hall at Cleveland State. Earlier this month, we featured 14 female composers. You know, the pool of female composers in chamber and the symphonic world is very small. And for females of color, it's you know, significantly smaller than that. And Amber Rogers, who is our executive director of our Local 4 Music Fund, our nonprofit, conceived this idea. And I just thought it was a great idea. And quite frankly, it's catching on with local foundation and philanthropic groups. And we're all just button-busting proud of this little festival.
Very cool. Now, what's happening on it's this Sunday. There's a Juneteenth celebration at Kane Park. Can you give us some details on that?
Sure. We have Evelyn Wright from the Cleveland Jazz Orchestra singing, led by a band led by Ed Ridley, who's the music director du jour at Playhouse Square Foundation and the Caramoo House. We have a who's who of Cleveland all-star singers, Ron Davis, Pat Harris, Tony Dial, Shirley Cook, Merle Johnson, who's also, has served with dignity at the Ohio State Board of Education. We're going to perform from 1 o'clock to 4 o'clock. We have three sets. The Ohio Alliance for Community Engagement is offering to the first 200 patrons one free food item and one free drink from the concession stand. We're going to spread the gospel, lift our voices, and have a lot of fun doing it.
I love it. Okay, one more issue here. Cleveland Orchestra, the best band in the land, often quoted.
Boy.
I understand that some negotiations with the Playhouse Square are underway. Can you fill us in on that, Lynn?
Well, in terms of the Cleveland Orchestra, what's interesting about that bargaining unit is that this orchestra committee in negotiation years does double duty. So in addition to the preparation and the analysis and follow-through of the collective bargaining issues, they also have to handle all the grievances and mediation from their rank and file. And along the way this year, they've also settled two grievances in regards to electronic media and additional services and subscription programming. They're just doing yeoman's work. And in terms of Playhouse Square Foundation, you know, this is our first introduction to Craig Hassel, the CEO, the new CEO, and he's from the UK. He was from Royal Albert Hall, and you know how Labour's working in UK as well. They're also under attack. We've had good interactions with him, and I'm really optimistic that we're going to have a deal real soon.
All right. Well, you got a lot going on, my friend. Len DeCosimo, president of the North Shore AFL-CIO Federation of Labor, also head of Local 4 of the American Federation of Musicians. I'm going to throw out two websites here, NorthShoreAFLCIO.org and Local4AFM.org. You stay safe, get some sleep, my brother, and we'll talk down the road, okay?
Thanks, brother. Flash all the way.
That'll be it for another edition of America's Workforce. Tomorrow, the latest from the American Legion and the Alliance for Retired Americans. Until then, all of you have a safe and wonderful day.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio podcast. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.